Kivalina is the village that sued the oil industry because the climate is warming and the village is eroding. The lawsuit was dismissed by the judge, but it's under appeal. The lawsuit is the subject of a book that shows it's part of a pattern. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. If they can't sue, what should Kivalina do? It's disappearing. Our number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. The bills are beginning to come in for the indirect costs of so much carbon emissions. More on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Yeah, especially this show. We'll probably say something. It's probably not possible to agree with everything that is said on this show today, no matter who you are. Well, the book is entitled Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. I just sort of came across this book on the web, and I thought, Kivalina, wait a minute. And it is indeed about Kivalina. I got the book. I got in touch with the author, who is a Dr. Christine Shearer. She's at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and she joins us now by telephone. Christine, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you.
I found your book a fascinating, basically, I wouldn't exactly call it a screed, but you're definitely trying to make a case here, wouldn't you say? I mean, wouldn't it be fair to say that you want to show the options for the people of Kivalina?
Yeah, it was definitely a look at the lawsuit they filed, which I had the sense that people didn't fully understand the fundamentals around the lawsuit, the history behind it, so I really wanted to explore that in the book.
And indeed you did. So you started in Kivalina, you ended in Kivalina, and you touch on Kivalina at various points in here, but a lot of it is about, other areas, other subjects, but they all sort of tie together through this issue of what you call the product defense industry. And what you basically do is draw a narrative of prior legal cases which essentially any one of them might have seemed a bit ridiculous, but as they keep going, sometimes eventually they turn out the other way. And one of the things that you use as an example is the tobacco litigation, which essentially there were, I don't know what, lawsuits over a period of like 20 years, maybe even longer, right?
Yeah, the 50s through, I mean, even today, but definitely up to the 1990s master settlement.
Yeah, and eventually the industry decided to settle, at least with the states. And as a result, each state, including Alaska, has got a stack of money from the that is theoretically for damages caused to public health in those states, costs that the states have to bear due to tobacco use in the past by people, right?
Yeah, the argument that the lawyers made was that states had been bearing that cost through healthcare costs because of damages from smoking. And that tobacco companies had some liability because they had tried to mask the dangers of smoking for so long. And more documents kept emerging that showed that that was a very deliberate attempt to mislead people about the health effects.
So the key point then was deliberate and knowing, I guess we would say.
Yeah, because it's one thing to say this is a scientific issue and we're going to do our own research. It's another thing to do research and publicity to try to mislead people. That overrides your First Amendment rights, and then lots of times it makes people angry that they've been misled.
And as I understand, what happened in the case of tobacco is that confidential information eventually got leaked out that showed that the people running the tobacco industry actually knew that smoking was harmful for your health and engaged in a conspiracy to conceal that knowledge. So the knowingly was there.
Right. Oh, absolutely. It's a very conscientious attempt.
So for lawyers that are listening to this, I'll let you get back to that. But for lawyers that are listening to this show, this is no surprise. But for people who are not, you know, familiar with legal cases, maybe it's a finer distinction than common sense would lead one to make, this business of knowingly.
Right.
Because it does seem that when you come then to the issue of climate change, that you could have a similar situation. That if you could get some internal documents, and indeed there are some already, that show the oil industry or, say, the coal industry or the power, electric power generation industry, all of whom were sued by Kivalina, to show that they knowingly, that they knew that carbon emissions were altering the climate, but that they were conspiring to, what shall I say, engineer a climate of doubt in public opinion. In other words, say funding denialists and setting up various institutes and think tanks that would then have experts to get on talk shows and talk about how it was, you know, there was something, you know, that the people that were pointing to humans as a cause of climate change were clearly nuts.
Yeah, or that the science is still under debate. But no, exactly. Many fossil fuel companies still maintain that the studies that they're doing, you know, or that they're funding are just scientific studies. But there are a few documents, and only a few at this point, that suggest that they know that the science on climate change cannot be denied. But that they continue funding studies to do exactly that, to try to deny it.
All right, so we've got this this knowingly standard. So maybe Kivalina's suit doesn't work, but maybe somebody else sues, and maybe that one works. And indeed, there have been other legal actions over climate warming, and they have worked their way up into, I guess, three different circuit appeals courts now. And the Kivalina case is now before the Ninth because it was filed for some reason in Northern California. And you basically, in your last chapter, your next to the last chapter, say the prospects may not be too good because the judge has kind of kneecapped this case, right?
The judges have kind of what? I'm sorry?
The judge has sort of kneecapped this case by creating a situation where maybe they wouldn't be able to enter this evidence on appeal.
Well, the district judge, dismissed the claim as a political question, meaning that the judge said it was not a matter for the judicial branch, that it was a matter for the executive and the legislative branches, climate change, because the issue is just too large. The judge said for the judicial branch to deal with it, which is how three prior public nuisance global warming cases had been ruled. But that decision's been appealed, and it was appealed. The oral argument for that was heard in November of 2011, so just a few months ago. And there is a sense that It will be a close decision. It was three judges that heard it. That it'll be a close decision, however it goes, but that it may go forward, in which case the claim could reach the discovery phase, and that, like you've been talking about, may unearth more documents showing that fossil fuel companies are knowingly trying to mislead people about climate change. And so even if Kivalina ultimately, you know, they don't get what they want is their relocation costs covered, which we'll probably get into. Even if they don't get to that stage, this may unearth more and more documents that will make people start to get angry and may lead to more lawsuits about what fossil fuel companies have been doing And if anything, at least get them to stop funding studies to mislead people, because it's amazing how many people still think, you know, the science is under debate.
Well, they've kind of, do you think they have a good legal team for this, Kivlina? I mean, this is being done pro bono, as I understand. I mean, you know, I know people in Kivlina. It's not like they have very deep pockets up there.
Right. Well, they have quite, I think because it's a lot of people that really believe in this, they have a pretty good legal team. They have a group called the Center for Race, Poverty, and Environment. Unfortunately, the lead lawyer died in an auto accident, Luke Cole, so that was a loss for them. But there are other lawyers involved, including lawyers that have been part of the tobacco lawsuits, both on the side of tobacco and against it. So Steve Berman helped engineer the master settlement, and he's part of the legal team. And then Steve Sussman actually represented tobacco companies during a lot of those lawsuits. And then because of his wife, according to him, he decided to get involved in climate change issues. And as he was looking into it, he said he saw a lot of parallels between what fossil companies are doing and what tobacco companies did. And so he's part of it. So they have a pretty good legal team, considering that, yeah, you know, they don't have deep pockets, as you said.
Yeah. Well, you know, you would seem to think that maybe the courts aren't the best way, but they're kind of maybe there aren't too many options left. And, you know, this is just one of a number of communities that are in Alaska now, as you probably know, that are seeing some consequences from climate change. I mean, you could even argue that the lurching of the weather, the violence of the storms, the storm surges, all of this could be tied to an unbalancing of the climate due to the amount of carbon put into the atmosphere, which is piling up even as we speak. So it would seem that, you know, here's a whole world and here's carbon emissions, and they're involving the whole world. So it's kind of difficult to convince a court of a cause and effect situation in terms of strict liability. I mean, it's kind of a stretch, don't you think?
Well, the judges have basically ruled so far that the issue is so large, and that if judges were to make a determination, or if they were even allowed to allow legal claims about climate change to move forward, they have to make a cost-benefit analysis about, you know, are the emissions that are being released, is it worth the cost? Which they say is not their job. They're not equipped to do that. Lawyers that have been bringing the lawsuits argue, no, this is more just a simple matter of assessing whether it's causing, whether carbon emissions are causing unnecessary harm, which is the doctrine of federal public nuisance, that no one has the right to cause unnecessary harm. But you're right in terms of the liability issues are starting to get huge. On the other hand, a lot of these lawsuits were initially brought during the Bush administration because the Bush administration was absolutely refusing to act on climate change. The legislative branch has yet to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, so there was some frustration with the state attorneys general that the political branches of government were not addressing the issue, and that's why they brought lawsuits, lots of states brought lawsuits. And Kivalina, which is, like many communities in Alaska, facing permanent displacement, also brought a lawsuit. And it was also a way to use another branch of government to really put this issue on the table and have people start dealing with it.
So where we stand with the legal precedents, as I understand it, is that there was a ruling from the Supreme Court, wasn't it, on the EPA, and they were basically told they should regulate carbon dioxide, right?
Yeah, the EPA under the Bush administration basically adopts the line of the Bush administration that they were not going to regulate greenhouse gases because it would hurt the U.S. position in international climate negotiations, which was an interesting argument since Bush was saying the U.S. was not going to be part of international climate negotiations. So states led by Massachusetts challenged the EPA on that and eventually got to the Supreme Court, who said in 2007 to the EPA, no, you have to make some sort of determination about greenhouse gases. You can't just say that you aren't going to address this issue. And so under the Obama administration, the EPA said, you know, we've made a determination about greenhouse gases. Yes, they are leading to unnecessary harm, and so we need to regulate. And so they're still in the process of moving towards eventually regulating greenhouse gases.
So this gets a little bit off the point, but I know this is part of your subject expertise because you're involved with the Coal Swarm Wiki. Should the and the EPA has begun to take some steps, some enforcement steps against the Ohio Valley power plants, which I personally have seen these power plants, and there is no question there's a lot of emissions out of them. It's my understanding that they're probably illegal. they're probably illegal, and they're going to get even more illegal as time goes on. And I guess what I'm asking out of all this is what the EPA appears to be trying to do now is to suggest to the industry that they make some tough decisions about what their next generation of technology is going to be for power generation, and that maybe they should turn their attention to gas rather than try to keep going with coal. Does that seem to be where the trend's going as far as the EPA's regulations are concerned?
Well, there's a lot of pending coal regulations that the EPA is simply now trying to do its job of implementing because a lot of them are long overdue. They've just been fought for so long. So you have regulations on sulfur dioxide emissions, nitrogen oxide emissions, mercury emissions, coal waste, particulate matter, I mean, the list goes on. And these are all long overdue. And so the EPA is moving towards finally implementing that, which would force a lot of coal companies to, you know, should we install the pollution controls to be within regulations for these emissions, or should we look towards something else? And so, as you said, some companies are instead looking towards natural gas, which they said will be cheaper, is less polluting when it's burned. There's a lot of questions about whether the entire life cycle is less polluting because you have to ship natural gas. It's composed of methane, which leaks, which is a greenhouse gas, a very powerful greenhouse gas. So there's still lots of questions around that. But, yes, exactly, as the EPA moves forward with coal regulations, it may force different power companies to consider whether they want to continue with using coal in the future.
Yeah, I bring this up because in Alaska, as you probably know, there's a lot of natural gas, and they don't seem to be able to find a market sizable enough to generate the financing for any kind of pipeline. So now they're thinking maybe they'll go the LNG route. But I have been questioning our policymakers. I said, why aren't you opposing burning coal in the Ohio Valley? Because that would up the demand for gas. I never get anywhere with that suggestion, but it just seems to make sense to me. That
right.
Yeah, I mean, coal it puts out more carbon than gas. You're right, I think, that somebody has to look more closely, and I doubt that really good work has been done on this yet, is the whole life cycle situation for natural gas, because it is, I mean, they do flare it some places where it comes out, but I'm sure lots of it is, it gets out there and it is methane. And that's not even to bring up what the consequences might be from fracking and all the other things that they're doing to extract it nowadays. There could be some...
Right, yeah, I think that's been the larger issue for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. So
water polluting from... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but we're kind of drifting a little bit away from the erosion question. I noticed in your book that you did talk some with the Denali Commission. There was a point, I think, when Ted Stevens was still alive, that it was thought that the Denali Commission would be the means, the vehicle by which these erosion problems which are popping up or wearing down, I guess more accurately, all around the state would be addressed. The Denali Commission pretty quickly threw up its hands and said, we don't have the money for this.
Really?
And it's true. I mean, you probably looked into the situation of Shishmaref, which is the most acute, although Kivalina is a very close second. It's not an easy thing, but whatever it is, it's an expensive thing. So how much are they asking in this lawsuit?
Well, they're asking for their relocation costs to be covered, Kivalina, which various government estimates have put at $100 to $400 million, which people of Kivalina say they think is a large estimate because it usually includes having to add sediment to an area so that it will be stable and it won't erode, and they say that there's lots of questions about this cost and whether it's necessary, but those are the estimates for right now.
It's the last chapter, I have to tell you, is just kind of frightening to somebody that covers news. You know, it's hard to get news from up there. And you have all the story in one chapter here of the various efforts to fight the erosion and the suggestions that have been made for relocation. And it's just a sad story. I mean, these poor people just cannot get a break. I mean, they finally get money from the Corps of Engineers because it's an emergency. The Corps of Engineers says, okay, we'll take care of it. And it ends up with some 8A belonging to NADA Corporation, which for some reason takes these wire baskets and fills them up with sand. So guess what happens when the next waves come through? I mean, of all the cockamamie.
I know, and the people of Kivalina said, we don't think this is going to work. And
yeah, and the same thing on, okay, if we relocate, they want to go one place, but all the experts are telling them, no, that's not good. You should go other places because this place will also erode or whatever. You know, it's just we want you to go inland, you know, where we already got gravel. And it just goes on. And these are always, the Newtok situation was a really messy one. And the Shishmaref is a messy one. You know, there are people in Shishmaref even now that say, you know, we're going to keep building revetments, man. We're going to defend our island. We can do this. We just throw enough money in there. I mean, it's, you know, these are not easy. But it doesn't appear to me that there's great sensitivity on the part of the bureaucrats that are supposed to be dealing with this. And then, as you point out, well, there really isn't any specific agency to deal with this, especially if you subtract the Denali Commission, which is, you know, doesn't have money anymore.
Yeah, and just to let people know, they probably do, but in Kivalina, because of warming Arctic temperatures, the ice on the coastline forms later and later in the year, and so when the storms come, that's just eating up the island, leading to erosion. Several government reports have said they need to relocate. And like you said, there's no government body in charge of relocation, and we don't really even have relocation policies in place. So I think the government representatives that are charged with having to assist the different communities being affected, which is not just Kivalina, but also Shishmaref and Newtok, they don't really have the policies in place to be able to really help these people, to be able to really relocate them. So I think there's a lot of difficulties there as well, and difficulties that need to be addressed.
Yep, and I don't think we got any answers here. Let's see if Elston does. Elston, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you very much. This is a great discussion. I'm really glad that you're doing this, Steve. It's a subject that needs to be talked about. And I just wanted to mention that I had published an article on the Mudflats blog before the last election entitled, How Many Votes Will Lisa Murkowski Get in Kivalina? And the reason for that rhetorical question is because I noted in the article that after the California court basically closed the lawsuit because of what they felt was a conflict with basically separation of powers, the federal court jurisdiction over a matter of politics. The attention moved to Congress because it became a congressional issue. And once the district court in California agreed with the defendants that this had to be debated in Congress and dealt with in Congress, Jeffrey Homestead, who was a major lobbyist for Duke Energy, who is one of the defendants in the Kivalina v. ExxonMobil lawsuit, turned his attention to Congress, and they needed to staunch in it the challenges that may arise in Congress so that they could block their liability that might arise from any congressional urges to deal with the issue of tort and damages arising from global warming. And Lisa Murkowski became their vehicle. And she was perfectly suited to do this. She had past credibility on the issue because she had worked with Senator Bingaman and others on the issue. And she was facing political jeopardy from her conservative base. So the political assault on clean air and global warming policy was perfectly aligned with the anti-government sentiment ignited by the corporate-funded Tea Party insurgency. And Lisa could benefit greatly by climbing aboard, and she did. And so in a word, Lisa threw Kivalina under the bus. And so I raised the rhetorical question, how many votes will Lisa get out of Kivalina?
You know, did you take a look and see?
Yeah, she carried Kivalina.
Wouldn't you know it? they know what's good for them.
He also moved to strip the EPA.
It really is shocking. Mother Jones had an article about this very issue of Jeffrey Homestead's work with Lisa Murkowski's office on what was called the Dirty Air Amendments to the Clean Air Act. And he basically drafted that Clean Air Amendment for Lisa's staff. And Duke Energy and the others were major contributors to her her reelection campaign. So, you know, there's the political side of this, and Alaskans really need to pay attention to this stuff. And I'm glad you brought the subject up, and this is yet to play out.
It is indeed. And as you know, Elston, I mean, when it comes to politics, people don't always take positions they believe in. As we see, you know, because it's so partisan, one party lays out extreme views on one side, and the other party lays out extreme views on the other side, and then they, you know, negotiate, as they say.
Yeah, except we haven't seen much negotiation in this Congress.
Everybody seems to be seeking a new strategy, but I don't know as the public is liking the new strategies they're finding. Thanks, Elston.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. We're speaking with Christine Shearer, author of Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. This is published by Haymarket Books, and it is basically a book that goes into the situation of Kivalina and its lawsuit. Kivalina is up in the Northwest Arctic on the coast of the Chukchi Sea. It's located on a spit. The spit was not some place where the villagers would have chosen to probably locate, but the missionaries thought it was a good place for the school. And so then people moved there because they wanted their children to go to the school, plus it's legally required. And so the result was that there's a town there, and of course that means it's not only a school but fuel tanks and all that. And now with the climate warming and the ice not icing up as early as it once did in the fall, the storms come through and just send these big waves onto this spit, and it's eating up the village. I mean, seriously eating up, like flooding over frequently its airstrip so that you can't fly in and out, and it goes on and on. And the people there, don't really get heard. I think that's fair to say. They don't get heard, and often when there are efforts to help them, they're well-intentioned but don't necessarily hit the mark, and that's definitely illustrated in this. So what else could they do besides pursue their legal case, Christine Shearer?
Well, as you pointed out, there was a failed seawall, but then the Army Corps of Engineers moved in, and so now they have a better seawall, but it's only for erosion. It's not for flooding, so that remains a concern. And they told me that for that the big storm that hit in November, that they were close to flooding. So another thing they could do is what the Government Accountability Office has recommended, which is to push for there to be a government agency that is responsible for relocation. I know you said that Denali has said, oh, well, we don't have the money for this, but some people in Denali told me they would be interested in being that government agency, but, yeah, that money would have to be allocated so that they'd have the funding to be able to do it, or some other government agency. Or at least to push to have some sort of relocation policy. Because right now the problem is everything is falling on Kivalina to try to coordinate their own relocation and having to do so by negotiating with several different government agencies at different levels with different norms, with different practices. And so when you really think about that, it's not difficult to see why their relocation has been so slow and stalled. They've been wanting to relocate since the early 90s, and, you know, it hasn't really moved forward. Because if you put everything on them to organize all of this, that's quite a burden. And so having some sort of agency in charge or relocation policy to offer a roadmap to really help them move forward with this would be a big step.
And you sort of take a dim view of the NUTOC, the way the NUTOC has been approached, although at least they are relocating.
Well, the way that they had their road constructed was through an Army Innovative Trainingness program, which, you know, it's great that they found a way to have that done, but I think there needs to be, they don't need to, how to put this, it would be nice if that was already something that would be a policy in place for them to make sure that they can get an evacuation road, that they don't kind of have to look for other ways to, you know, to get something that they basically need. Because if they're in danger, they obviously need an evacuation road. And so there should just be a policy in place to make sure that they get it.
Yeah, I see. It's kind of like there's the right way, the wrong way, and the military way, and they get no choice. It's a military way. Well, and it has to be done according to the military priorities, and that's all a matter of how the law and regulation. Christine, I'll get back to you in a moment as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Rarely do I refer to the announcements heard during this program, but I will say that we just had an announcement that I'm sure was paid for, was funded by the tobacco settlement that the state of Alaska got. I'm absolutely certain of it. And that's part of what we're talking about today, which is the litigation of the village of Kivalina over climate change, carbon emissions causing their village to erode. And they sued the oil companies. They sued the coal companies. They sued the power companies. The judge dismissed the suit, but it's on appeal before the Ninth Circuit, and there are other cases of this nature. And the comparison is made by the author Christine Shearer between this and the asbestos litigation and the lead paint situation and the tobacco, above all the tobacco litigation, where it was shown that the tobacco industry was basically paying for a propaganda campaign telling people that smoking didn't harm your health, and this went on for years. And once all this came out, once this evidence was shown in the courts, that went to the issue of knowingly. And the question here is there another knowingly with the energy industry and climate change? Is the energy industry been going beyond due diligence and protecting shareholder value and actually got to the point where it's lying to the public and encouraging a climate of doubt when scientists really don't have any doubt? Well, the subject I put out was, what's behind climate change denial? And an answer comes from Jim in Haynes by email. Says, maybe there's nothing behind it, but a public with a good nose for when too many things don't pass the common sense test. An example, years of claims of warm weather was evidence of global warming, followed by the current claims that storms and even cold weather are evidence for human-caused climate change. So as far as Jim's concerned, that's just violates common sense. So, Dr. Shearer, I want to go back to this business of there being no real recourse for these eroding communities. Usually what you do in a situation like that is you organize. Maybe we just haven't seen it yet, but it would seem like we want to have an Eroding Villages Caucus or something like that. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, the people of Kivalina could best speak to that. I don't know if they're just so. It's difficult because being in remote different areas, or if they are moving towards that, I don't know.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, the number is a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And our guest is Dr. Christine Shearer, author of Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. She is at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And how did you come to write this book? You say at one point you were a journalist. Now you're an academe. But did this come out of your journalistic endeavors?
I think it did. I think the journalist in me heard about this lawsuit and thought, well, I have to write about this.
Well, my heavens, you could have picked a less expensive place to go.
Yes, definitely. Part of my interest was I had been part of a marine science project looking at the biggest human impacts to marine ecosystems. And it was one of the things where I knew about climate change, but as I was working on this project and working with scientists and talking to a lot of scientists, I really understood just how bad it was and how quickly it was happening and that it's, you know, the effects are potentially irreversible if we let it go too far. And so that really got me thinking, this was 2007, about the disconnect between what science knew and what most people were hearing, which was that, you know, the science was still under debate. And so when I heard about this lawsuit in 2008, I thought, you know, that's interesting. And I liked that, you know, A, it was stated in various government reports that Kivalina is eroding because of climate change. So it's right there in black and white. You get past the whole, is it happening, is it not happening, you know, pseudo debate. And then B, that they were holding fossil fuel companies accountable for misleading people. And so that's what got me interested in it.
And you did an awful lot of research. I mean, I my hat's off to you in terms of research. And then you have copious and abundant footnotes. See, there you are in academia, and you figured out how to do this now. So people can actually follow the evidence trail. If they think you're making an outrageous assertion, they can go check the sources for themselves.
Yeah, exactly. With something like this, where it's this controversial, where, you know, there's so much under debate whether it should be or not, I knew it was important to really be sourced.
But you found some of the same people. Some of the same people involved with, the tobacco situation are the same people that are now essentially putting out climate change denial stuff. The same people.
Yeah, exactly. And Naomi Oreskes, the science historian, explored this in her book, Merchants of Doubt, as well, this small group of government scientific advisors that started off, they were part of the Cold War, and they were really promoting nuclear weapons, and then they really had a fallout with a lot of scientists over the potential harm of a nuclear winter, and said those concerns were exaggerated and overblown, and then they started to question the science on other things, like acid rain and the hole in the ozone layer and tobacco smoke, and so they really just kind of had this interesting transition from, you know, seeing national security in terms of promoting nuclear weapons to seeing national security in terms of fighting environmentalists and fighting scientists. And some scientists have, scientists outside of the government have also been found, you know, also disagreeing with the science on tobacco smoke and then climate change and then, you know, anything else that...
Mm-hmm. Well, you also even go to the National Academy of Sciences. Now, we did a show not too long ago on science, how science ain't getting no respect. And we had a scientist on, and he said, no, I really think that we have a pretty good system of peer review, and just that people don't understand it real well. And he went on to defend the National Academy of Sciences, which, you know, I would not. You know, I followed National Academy of Sciences for years, and it's all depends on who's on the panel. And you point to a couple of people who have chaired panels on the National Academy of Science that have definitely been part of this manufacturing of doubt.
Yeah, but they did it after serving in that role.
Ah.
Yeah. While they were serving.
It was not after. while they were actually running the panel.
Right.
Well, that's
and
that's
I think,
good.
And I know a lot of scientists want to think that science is completely divorced from politics, but scientists do have, you know, a very rigorous way of keeping their research in check. That I think we should respect. And it's unfortunate that, you know, when they talk about say how certain they are of something, they're talking about a very rigorous system of, you know, determining certainty. It's not like Glenn Beck getting on TV and saying, you know, he's certain that Obama's a Muslim. It's a very different, you know, standards of establishing data and evidence.
Well, if you compare it to that, yes. let's go to Ard, joins the program from the Wasilla area. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ard.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning to you and your guest. I'll try to be as brief as possible. What prompted the phone call is when I heard the discussion turn towards the power generation, coal-fired power generation in the Ohio River Valley. And although I am no longer involved in any sort of, I guess we could call it a debate or a battle regarding climate change, acid rain, dry particulate pollutants or anything else associated with coal-fired power generation, one point that I wanted to make, and I believe it still works very well today, for the power generation companies and for the political supporters in from the local to state to federal level, that those power companies, we'll leave it at that as their title, the power companies have political allies. And what I did is I started as a volunteer and never really was a funded, a salaried person. I was funded for my travel and expenditures, and I worked with and for the National Clean Air Coalition. And it was during the mid-1980s, and what we were trying to educate the general public on was the dangers of acid precipitation and all of the related health threats. And beyond health threats, climate change that were at that time and could in the future result from these massive amounts of emissions. And what I found back then is the most conclusive argument that the power companies made against retrofitting those existing power plants with an upgraded what was known in the lay language as a scrubber
Right, scrubbers.
But it's actually a flue gas desulfurization system. Their claim was that if the Clean Air Act was to be amended and those grandfathered plants were to be forced to install the flue gas desulfurization units, what this would amount to would be a threat to the general economy, to the individual. It would result in your electric bill. And I actually sat through a meeting. What I did is I had shown the film produced by the Canadian government, Acid Rain, Requiem or Recovery. That's an old movie. You used to have to show it on film reels. And I had shown the movie, and we actually had the chairman or director of the Pennsylvania State Public Utilities Commission present. Because the PP&L, Con Ed, and some other companies that supply power to PA, that's where I was living at the time, they wanted to raise their rates. So the rate increase and the fact that none of these plants were being retrofitted, it made for a good argument at the time that, you know, well, you're raising the rates and you're not doing any retrofitting. What's up with that? We're still going to have a rate increase. And one of the things that I found interesting, this threat that seemed to really resonate well with the individual, the private citizen at these meetings, was that nobody wanted to see their electric bill go up. And I had a poster board I had put together, and I had almost 7 full years of my statements from the PP&L company on that board. And then I had made a graph which showed the consistent increase in my power cost per kilowatt hour over that nearly 7-year period of time, during which there were absolutely no improvements made on pollution controls.
So they were already doing it, for Pete's sake.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Okay, well, where you, I got a call waiting from Shishmaref here, so I want you to, if you can wrap it up here.
I'll make it, and for all of the listeners here in Alaska, the one thing I would really like people to do is when we have clear weather, especially during spring and summer, start looking up in the sky and start to wonder what is that stuff that comes out of those very high-flying aircraft in formation that forms this continual ceiling of stratification over top of us, which blocks the sun. Regardless of the weather forecast, 5 days of clear weather coming, when you hear that forecast, start looking up. And those 5 days of clear weather usually don't show up. And I think that, you know, we need to start looking up in the sky. We're pretty much like deer walking through the forest, like moose. You know, they don't look up. They just look forward. They're looking for what's in front of them, when actually I think what's above us is affecting our ambient, our local weather conditions.
Well, I would say that that used to be Art Bell material, but it's beyond that now. And I used to kind of laugh at that, snicker at that, but I'm not snickering anymore. Art, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. It is Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Robert from Shishmaref, you're on Talk of Alaska with Christine Shearer.
Yeah, good morning. This is Robert here in Shishmaref, and I had a question, you know, on the relocation issue, you know, since Shishmaref's been on the hot topics for a relocation for a number of years.
Yes, go ahead, Robert.
I've, you know, our basic infrastructure here in our community, you know, are declining, are outdated. We're living in a third world country, if you don't mind me saying. And the water and sewer, we're still, using these basic governor, what's his name, that wanted a honey bucket in the museum. Obviously, they didn't find the funding for that either. But, you know, it's our basic supply of fuel and gas, supply of our tank farms are eroding from the inside out. And, you know, our basic supply of fuel is going to be declining before we know it. And we're being forced to, you know, set aside whatever funding that is available for the relocation. But then again, there ain't any money for relocation, period.
Yeah, and I guess, Robert, where do you stand? Would you like to live out your days in Shishmaref, or are you ready to move? You know, if so, where?
Well, that came up a number of times, you know, with my thought. But then again, actions are better than your words, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really appreciate you calling because one thing I think you're pointing out is disinvestment in your community right now. Like Denali Commission says, oh, this is unsustainable. We don't want to put more money into that. So there you are with your honey buckets. I mean, that's just kind of crazy. And it also goes, Christine, maybe you want to comment on this because this is the very messiness of the situation that you were talking about with Kivalina, that it's just not a simple thing when you get up close to it.
Yeah, I think Kivalina is facing the same sorts of problems where they might need some sort of upgrade or, you know, retuning, but then they face the issue of, well, if you're going to relocate, we don't want to put the money into that. And so same problems that Robert is talking about with Shishmaref.
Yeah. Robert, anything else you want to add?
Yeah, it's you know, it's a funny thing, you know, ever since Senator Stevens, you know, passed on and lost his seat in the Senate, you know, we never did see a senator or representative come to our community, not like Senator Stevens was coming 2-3 times a year. He was for our community, you know, on this relocation issue. And, you know, with the state representatives that we have now, you know, we got no chauffeurs here.
So, yeah, that's I'm glad you pointed that out. In other words, since Stevens died, you're really not seeing anything out there, huh?
Right.
Okay.
It's painful. It's no way the government should be supporting a community, you know, in the United States. Yeah.
Robert, thank you so much for picking up the phone and being part of the show here today. Brenda in Petersburg, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thank you. Good morning. I wanted to backtrack and ask some comments in regards to the product protection that had been brought up just kind of briefly. You know, we have millions and billions of dollars that come from pharmaceutical companies to treat cancer victims. And I think that it's real challenging to see how companies like Monsanto, where they're doing genetically modified foods and have, you know, their CEOs that go into government offices, and so much of all of what we eat today is hidden. We don't know the contents of the foods and the combinations. I saw Food Inc. and Future Food and how a genetically modified tomato is combined with the genetics of a halibut via E. coli, and that's how we have long-lasting red, tasteless tomatoes on the market. But my concern is that with the product protection that she'd brought up, where or how the public can obtain education, information, support for change, anything along those lines.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think anybody's got a great answer for that. Dr. Shearer, you know, we in the journalistic community haven't been doing the greatest job on deconstructing and straining the BS out of all this stuff, I don't think.
yeah, and in terms of what she brought up, David Michaels is actually the one who coined the term product defense industry, because his argument was, you know, all these efforts and David Michaels is the Assistant Secretary of Labor. He argued that all these efforts to undermine regulations or to prevent, you know, say, consumer information about about knowing about what they're consuming or what they're buying. It's larger than just a PR effort. He thinks he's related it to an entire industry that he's called the product defense industry. But I think it also gets into the larger issue of corporate money and corporate influence over politics. And so there is a movement right now to at least roll back what was done with the Citizens United, the 2010 Supreme Court decision that undid limits on how much corporations could pour into campaigns and into elections and influencing policy. And so, for example, they can create a super PAC that doesn't have any limits and then fund it anonymously through a 501c4 organization. And so people can at least support efforts to amend the Constitution to roll back that decision. There's a lot of energy and movement for that right now, different groups like Public Citizen and Move to Amend. And I think that's one way to at least try to get the corporate influence over politics and policies and decisions to at least roll that back a bit.
Yeah, and often on this program, people are just choosing to be more choosy about what they eat. You know.
Yeah.
It's really quite a revolutionary act to take responsibility for your own food security, and you know, people are doing that. I mean, it may not be much, but it's something.
Yeah, and people are educating themselves, and it can take effort, but trying to find that information, or at least as much as it can, and, yeah, making decisions based on that information.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Christine, and I look forward to whatever it is that you end up doing with nanotechnology or whatever your next efforts are going to be, because this is certainly an excellent thing, and I think one thing that we end up with is we don't have good, easy answers, but we could start moving in that direction. Do you think, you know, if you had to rewrite the books right now, would you say, okay, it'll be the Denali Commission, they'll be in charge of it, and just see to it that they had the resources to do it?
I wouldn't make that decision, but I would like to see that decision made and an agency allocated.
That somebody would do it.
Yeah.
Because you know, as you point out, they said, if it's National Guard, it's military nowadays. If it's Corps of Engineers, it's got to be an emergency, and it just seems to be this can't be handled that way. We're gonna have to think about this. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.